All righty, everybody. Oh, that's a little bit loud. Let me turn that down. Hello, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is May 5th. We're going to start the respiratory chapter today, and I think that sounds pretty good. So let's just check in on the schedule to make sure that I'm on track here. So today's May 5th. Yep, respiratory system, and it's really close to chapter 22, might even be chapter 22. I don't know, what do you have in your books, 22 or 23? 22 is good? Okay, so today's the 5th, next week's the 12th and the 19th. Okay, so in, let's see, two and a half weeks is your last exam in here, right? Exam number 4, we could call it a final exam because it's your last one, but it's not cumulative, but you probably have to know some stuff through the whole class, right, to be able to understand questions like medial, lateral, superior, deep, right, all that kind of stuff you should really know. So the chapters on that last exam will be 19 through 25, with no exception. So 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. Fortunately, they're really short chapters. Right, lymphatics you could probably do in one evening, but of course you should review as well. All right, and don't forget on that very last week, since there's not a finals week anymore, your last practicum and your last lecture exam will be during that week. And those of you that have lab on Monday will have, you'll just get the practicum on Monday, but not the lecture exam. But those of you that have lab on Wednesday will get lecture exam and practicum on the same day. That kind of switched compared to how it was on April 21st. Right, it went the other way around. Any questions on the schedule whatsoever? All right, so what do we got to cover today? Respiratory, and then later, before the final, digestive, urinary, and diversification system. And oh, we got two periods for that. So we've got more than enough time. All right, so no question. All right, well, I better shut up and get started talking about some of this stuff. Respiratory system, here we go. All right, so of course we're going to learn all the structures like lungs and air passageways and things like that. All right, but probably we should start by understanding what the functions of the respiratory system are, and that will support our understanding of what these structures are. All right, so the first thing, ventilation, that's breathing. Right, moving air in and out of our body, and in particular the lungs, is breathing in and out, in and out, in and out. And what that does is that it brings an important chemical, oxygen, into our body that we need to make energy, or mitochondria need oxygen to make energy in the form of ATP for us. And in so doing, when it makes ATP, mitochondria produce CO2. And CO2 will be toxic to us, and so when we exhale CO2. When we inhale, we're actually inhaling oxygen into our body. All right, so that exchange takes place in the lungs. So I just used a key term, and I see it right here, exchange. What kind of blood vessels does the lung have in order for exchange to take place? Yeah, it's got to have a capillary in there someplace, right? And it's got to have an artery bringing blood away from the heart to the lungs, and then a vein bringing blood back from the lungs to the heart. And what would we want to call those arteries and veins, since it deals with the lung? Because anytime you hear pulmonary or pulmono, you should think of lungs, right? So those would be the pulmonary arteries and lungs. All right, so besides breathing air in and out of our lungs, we have to be concerned with that gas exchange. Then the gas exchange between air in the lungs and blood, that's via a capillary, because remember, those are the only ones that exchange takes place because they're the thinnest. And then also that transport in oxygen and CO2 in the blood. That happens by a couple of different ways. CO2 dissolves in fluid very readily. Oxygen, on the other hand, doesn't like to dissolve in water. So there has to be a special mechanism that can carry oxygen everywhere in our body. Right? But that's an important part of the respiratory system. And as a matter of fact, maybe you are aware already of what kind of blood cell can carry oxygen for us. It's specially designed to carry oxygen, and it is a red blood cell, and it's colored red because it's loaded with a compound called hemoglobin, and when hemoglobin binds oxygen, it looks bright red. So there's a pigment, right? A pigment is just anything that gives color to something, and there's a red pigment in hemoglobin. All right, and then gas exchange not only should happen in the lungs, but should happen in the tissues as well, between blood and tissues. All right, so let's fill in this this list right here. All right, what circulation does gas exchange take place between air and lungs? What circulation is responsible for that? Yeah, pulmonary circulation. Remember, how many sides does a heart have?
Two.
Two, yeah, right and left. So the right side pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation. All right, and then what circulation is important for gas exchange between blood and tissues? Yeah, systemic. It's the other one. So think of those two things. All right, so now let's begin to start to study some of the structures. And we have a nice slide here on the right. And here we have the oral cavity. We're aware of that. And here's your nose, and we got a couple of nostrils, and we got a nasal septum that separates the two nostrils out. That's what we're aware of. We're not really so much aware of our nasal cavity, but it's a large cavity posterior to our nose. I see it right here. And maybe I see some other things. Here's the opening that goes to your middle ear, right? Does anybody remember what that tube is that goes to your middle ear from here? That is the? Yeah, eustachian tube, auditory tube, laryngo, tympanic tube, tympanic because that's the ear, right? And we say laryngo because the back of the mouth right here, right, and is the pharynx, and this back of the nasal cavity and is what we call the nasal pharynx. Okay. I see some shelves inside the nasal cavity. This is for moisturizing air when it's too dry. It warms air up if it's too cold, cools air down if it's too hot, so that we don't desiccate our lungs, turn them into potato chips, for instance, if it's really dry outside, or if it's really hot, we don't burn our lungs. And if it's really cold, right, if you're up in the mountain someplace where it's really cold, you don't freeze your lungs. So these are the nasal concha that we have looked at before. All right, so then down below the oral cavity, we have the larynx. And I see some blue structures in the larynx. All these blue structures represent cartilage, right? So cartilage is kind of stiff. It can take a form, all right, but it's a lot lighter than bone. That's the beauty. And the other thing about cartilage is that some kinds of cartilage is very bendy, so it can bend, and it has elastic properties, so after it's done bending and you let go of it, then cartilage goes back to its original position and size and shape. So that's handy. All right, so here is the larynx. Then here is a windpipe, and from the larynx down through the mediastinum, that windpipe is what we call the trachea. Trachea. And it has, does it have cartilage too?
Yes.
Yeah, I see some cartilage right in there. And then when it gets down to this level right here, I see a bifurcation, which means what? It splits into two. And here is the left bronchus, here's the right bronchus, and we could call this a primary bronchus. After the bifurcation from the trachea, this first bifurcation, you could call it a primary, or you could say it's the main bronchus. And if we go further into the lungs, we have a bronchus, and then it bifurcates once again. And if this first one is the primary bronchus, then what are these over here? These would be secondary bronchi. And then even smaller ones after this bifurcation, this would be tertiary bronchus. And does this tertiary bronchus right here, does it have cartilage?
No.
Take a look. Ah, look at that. There's cartilage. So, yes, bronchi do have cartilage. Right? And then I see it bifurcating once again. And these are going to be actually microscopic structures. These are what we call bronchioles. And bronchioles, as you can see on this illustration, do not have cartilage. They have smooth muscle, so they can constrict and they can dilate. Right? But there's nothing holding them open all the time, like I see this cartilage in this location. All right, so what else do I see in the lung? So I got the left lung here and the right lung, and it looks like the left lung is bigger. No, it looks like the right lung is bigger than the left lung. Could that possibly be true, or is that a misdrawing? That's probably true. Okay, why do you think that's true? Oh yeah, so the heart has to fit into this notch, right? So here's the cardiac notch. And you can't have a lung and a heart in the same place. All right, so that's why the right lung is a little bit bigger. It has three lobes, while the left lung only has two, right? So here's a superior, middle, and distal, or inferior. Superior, middle, and inferior lobes of the lung. There's only superior and inferior on the left side. Okay, and since you might notice on this illustration, maybe I'll point it out again, that the left main bronchus is smaller than the right main bronchus. And so this diameter here is larger than over here. Another thing that I notice is that the right main bronchus is more lined up with the trachea. It's more straight up and down, but the left one has to go almost through a 90-degree turn. That has some important ramifications later that I'll talk about in lecture. Okay, so we have the larynx down over here with all that cartilage. I see some cartilage. Let me click right into here. We're going to take a look at some of these in just a second. So here is the larynx, and here is the pharynx. The pharynx is the back of your mouth. And another way of thinking of pharynx is, anybody think of a common name for your pharynx? We hardly talk about it as pharynx, but we talk about it all the time. This is your, that's your throat. Okay, so throat and pharynx are the same thing. So when you have an inflammation back here, you have a pharyngitis, guess what we commonly call that? We call that a sore throat, right? So pharyngitis and sore throat are exactly the same thing, right? But you've maybe noticed another kind of pathology. Maybe when you get a sore throat or a cold, you also lose your voice, right? And what do we call it when somebody loses their voice? Is that a pharyngitis? Do you ever call that pharyngitis? We call it typically by its scientific name. Unlike pharyngitis, we just say sore throat. But we say when we lose our voice, it's called a laryngitis, right? And so indeed, this is the larynx right here. The pharynx is a passageway for air and food, both. But the larynx should be a passageway only for air. There shouldn't be any food getting into the larynx. Because if food does enter the larynx, that I see right here, then gravity will pull it into the trachea because the trachea is held open all the time by these cartilaginous rings. Right? And it can fall all the way down to here. Maybe it gets lodged in one of these bronchi. And since the right one is bigger than the left, if something does get lodged, it usually gets lodged in the right side of the body because it's more of a straight shot in there and it's a bigger tube. So somebody gives away their right lung when, what do we call that, when you can't breathe? Okay, what do we call it when you can't breathe? Maybe you were eating something and it went down the wrong pipe, so to speak. Okay, and so you should know what that's called. And also, right, you should be able to give me the hand signals for that, because when you're in the process of doing this, you can't speak. You can't ask for help. So we call that choking, yeah. So when something enters the larynx, right, and all it has to do is just get over, and then gravity will pull it down into the trachea or a bronchus right here. We call that choking because we can't breathe in and out. So we can't get oxygen into our body. And what does that mean? That could be fatal, right, if that airway doesn't get cleared. So I'm sure there's some people that are certified in here to help clear people's airways if they get occluded with food particles. Anybody certified in here to do that?
Yeah.
And what's that called? That's a Heimlich maneuver, right. Okay. All right, so that's one ramification of having the trachea held open all the time with this cartilage, because stuff can fall in there. So you might be wondering, well, that sounds pretty dangerous. Why do we have this cartilage in the trachea? Why is it held open? Why is the larynx held open? Why are these bronchi held open all the time? And that's because when we breathe in and out, as a matter of fact, especially when we breathe out, we have to pressurize our thoracic cavity, right? And when we pressurize our thoracic cavity, it puts pressure on all of these tubes, and if it didn't have cartilage holding it open, then they would collapse. And even if there's air in the lungs and these tubes collapse, then air couldn't leave. And that's a really bad thing, because if air doesn't leave, what does that mean? New air can't go in. So these passageways have to be held open all the time so that we can inhale and exhale. But as a result, okay, somebody could choke to death because that trachea is held open all the time. Okay, so this is the larynx right on top of the trachea. Here is your throat or the pharynx, and the pharynx has three parts to it. The one right behind the oral cavity is what we call the oropharynx. The one right behind the nasal cavity is what we call the nasopharynx. And the one that's right behind the larynx is called the laryngopharynx. Right? So those are all parts of your throat. Okay, so we can break it down into some of its pieces. Okay, so remember, larynx, what should pass through a larynx? Only air. What can pass through a pharynx? Food and air, that's right. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at the larynx in particular. I'm not going to talk about nasal cartilage or cartilages of the nose, but you could take a look at those. Oh, here's a nice illustration of nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx. And, this is probably the exam figure that shows the nice detail of the laryngopharynx, oropharynx, nasopharynx. And I see some other structures. Here's a nice oral cavity and the tongue. I'm going to get down to the larynx here in just a bit because I do want to talk about some of these things. Okay, here are those nasal conchae that I just talked about. Here is a posterior aperture that communicates with the nasal cavity and the nasopharynx. And here is the isthmus of the fauces between... Okay, the epiglottis right here and the uvula, which is this little, looks like a little tongue hanging down in the back from the roof of your mouth. So this is the isthmus of the fauces. An isthmus is just a narrowing of a passageway. And I see some glands right here. I see 1, 2, 3 glands. And these really, well, I guess they're part of the respiratory system, but they're also part of the lymphatic system. These are what we call tonsils. And these tonsils have germinal centers in them that can recognize a foreign antigen. And when they recognize a foreign antigen, they can develop some kind of immune response and tell the rest of the immune system how to recognize that antigen and fight that infection. All right, so here is one underneath the tongue. That's the lingual tonsil. So anytime you hear lingual, that's going to be tongue, right? Like the lingual side of a tooth is what? Like the medial side of a tooth that's touching the tongue, as opposed to the other side that's touching the cheek, that would be the buccal side. So we use lingual a lot. And here is one on either side of the uvula within the pharynx. These are what we call the palatine tonsils. And there's even one way up over here, right, in the nasal cavity, right? So we call this the pharyngeal tonsil. Okay, so some people do have a chronic infection of these tonsils. Sometimes when they get infected, they stay infected. Or the infection almost goes away and then the infection comes back. That can happen with an appendix as well, right? And if it's really bad, then that appendix can burst in the abdominal cavity and all that infected material ends up in your abdominal cavity. And if somebody has a chronically infected palatine tonsil, then they're going to come down with a sore throat or pharyngitis maybe every couple weeks, probably more frequent than every 3 weeks, probably every couple weeks, maybe even 2 colds in 1 week sore throat, right? And those sore throats might be so bad that you have to miss work, so it's really kind of it's more than a nuisance. It really messes up somebody's life. So guess what one of the treatments is for a chronically infected tonsil? Yeah, remove the tonsil, right? And it's in particular, it's the palatine tonsils that mostly get infected with a tonsillectomy, right? And tonsils, when they're inflamed like that, pretty much are as big as the tip of your thumb, and you have two of them, one on either side of the uvula. So you can imagine what it would be like, right, if we dug out a piece of tissue from some part of your body, maybe your shoulder, as big as the tip of your thumb. How would your shoulder feel? Terrible for a long time, right? So removing somebody's tonsil as an adult is a fairly serious surgery, and dang, I forgot. You get off work for at least 4 weeks. I don't think it's 6 weeks. 6 was rolling around in my mind. Is it 6 weeks? For sure 4 weeks, okay, because it's a major surgery, and since it's so inflamed, right, you have a lot of difficulty eating as well. So, but as a child, it's a relatively easy procedure. They're probably a... No issues at all. Yeah, you're probably up running around the very next day, and we should put them back to work, but they're probably not at work yet. Okay, so they'll for sure be eating ice cream. But for an adult, it could be a very painful surgery, but you know what? When those tonsils are removed, you might not have a sore throat or a cold for over a year. Right? Instead of having a cold two or three times a month, you're going to be disease-free for a year. And guess what? That's marvelous. That will completely change your life. Anybody experience that? Or am I over-speaking that a little bit? Anybody can confirm that that is true? You don't get sore throats anymore. Yeah. And you don't miss... Okay, so you can't miss a test for a sore throat. Okay, I was just checking everybody here. All right, so those are the tonsils. So they protect what? The nasal, the pharynx, and the larynx, and the digestive system, and the airways from infection. That's what their job is, part of the immune system. Okay, what else do I see here? Well, now, here is the larynx, and I see some cartilages, and some of these cartilages are pretty big. This cartilage, we call this the epiglottis. Epi means on top of the glottis, and the glottis is this opening into the larynx, which then opens into the trachea. So the glottis is really a hole. It's more like a foramen than a structure. But it's made up of some other structures. For instance, like the thyroid cartilage, which almost goes all the way around the larynx. It has a very prominent feature. It sticks out. That's the thyroid prominence. So you can see the thyroid cartilage. Another cartilage underneath it called the cricoid, that does completely encircle the larynx. And that might even be a little bit bigger than the thyroid cartilage, but it doesn't stick out quite so much as the thyroid cartilage. All right, so these don't have to bend necessarily, but they should be fairly strong just to keep the trachea open. But the epiglottis should be very bendy because sometimes it's down in this position covering the glottis, and other times it is angled up like this, uncovering the glottis. All right, and so it is bendy. Because when you're breathing, when you're inhaling, the epiglottis should be pointing straight up so that air can enter the glottis, then the larynx, and then the trachea to your lungs. But when you swallow some food or drink some water, we said we don't want that getting into an airway. That's when the epiglottis flops down over the glottis, and then food just kind of falls right over the superior margin, right, of the glottis, and it goes into this tube that takes it to the stomach. What is the name of this tube right here? Yeah, esophagus. And we're going to talk about the esophagus next time. All right? And does the esophagus have any cartilage on it? No cartilage, right? Only the trachea. That has some important ramifications, too. This we'll talk about next time. All right, but let's get back talking about this epiglottis. So this epiglottis works pretty well most of the time, right? But sometimes it doesn't work. And then when somebody swallows something, guess what happens? It gets into there. Yeah, it gets into their larynx and then maybe into their trachea, and then they start to choke. And then they can't speak. So what is that sign language for choking? So somebody might be CPR certified that can actually help breathe. All right, take your two hands like this and just put it right around your throat. So if you're starting to turn purple and nobody can tell you're turning purple, just do this like in a restaurant or something, and probably somebody will come over and try to help you by doing that Heimlich maneuver. All right. Well, the strange thing is that this epiglottis gets lazy on one particular day of the week. I don't know if any of you CPR certified know what day of the week do most people choke. And in particular, there's a time during that day that most people choke because this epiglottis right here just gets a little lazy. So who can help me out? Because sometimes I forget which day of the week it is. Well, I think I heard it. It is Friday. Somebody said Friday. Yeah, most people choke on a Friday. But what time Friday? Like around 5 o'clock during happy hour. Okay? So choking usually is associated with adult beverage, right? And maybe you're going out to work with a bunch of friends and share a pitcher of beer or some other kinds of drink. Oh, like today. You probably won't have beer today, right? Or a pitcher of margarita, or two pitchers of margaritas, and you're sitting around the table maybe eating some nachos, and you're chewing some nachos, and you're about ready to swallow, but you're not quite ready to swallow those nachos that you chewed up, but somebody tells a really good joke, like some joke about your anatomy instructor, right? So there you are, but see, you started to laugh right there, so all of a sudden you're about ready to swallow something, but you start laughing, but before you laugh, what do? You go, like that, and then laugh, and there goes that nacho right into the trachea. And then you start to choke. And if you start choking, then what should you do? Yeah, you're not laughing, you're turning purple, you got to do this, right? And then somebody can do that Heimlich maneuver if you're trained to do that, which is kind of a radical, violent maneuver where you really shove up against their stomach and force all their stomach and abdominal muscles up into the thoracic cavity, and that has a tendency to shoot stuff right out of their airway when that happens. Hopefully that does happen. But of course, before you do that, even if you're not an expert, you might want to try to do something like that rather than watch somebody choke to death, right? That would be the last thing you would want. But before you do that Heimlich maneuver, which is kind of a nasty maneuver, you that are CPR certified are told to do one thing before you perform that maneuver on somebody. What should you do? Because you have to get around behind them and grab with your fist and pull up really forcefully, right? Under normal circumstances, that would be, even if I were to do that to you in lab, that would be considered an assault, right? So you can't just do that to anybody. So the first thing you should do is always ask somebody, are you choking? And if they can't answer you, then that's a pretty good sign that they are choking, right? Unless maybe they don't speak your language, right? So just try to figure that out. But you can't walk around Heimlich maneuvering people, okay? Especially instructors. Don't do that to instructors. All right. So this epiglottis can get lazy, right? So pay attention when you're swallowing that it's operating perfectly. All right. In this region right here, and remember this is part of the larynx, so there's only air in here. There are some ligaments that stretch across the larynx, and when air passes over them, they vibrate. And so when something vibrates, that produces a tone, right, or a sound. And so these are the vocal cords. There's true and false. The true ones are down here. The vocal folds or false ones are a little bit superior to them. And there is a muscle and some cartilage that can adjust the tension on these vocal cords so that you can change the pitch of your voice, right? So you can talk a really high voice or a really low voice by changing the tension on those vocal cords. And the less tension there is on a vocal fold or a vocal cord, and the bigger it is, the lower the frequency that it will vibrate at. Typically, that's how it goes. So if somebody has a smaller larynx, then they will have a higher pitched voice compared to somebody that has a really big larynx, right? They have a lower pitched voice. And typically, males have, a bigger larynx or a smaller larynx? Usually bigger within a family, right? So males' voices are typically deeper than a female's voice just because of that. All right, so those are those vocal folds right in there. Okay, what are some other things? Oh, here, right? Here is a thyroid cartilage, and there's that laryngeal prominence. Let's look at an anterior and then a lateral view of the larynx. Well, you're familiar with this, right? Is that cartilage? No, that's bone, right? That's the hyoid bone that's tucked up in your mandible, and there's some ligaments and muscles attached to it, right? And then right below starts the larynx. So here is the thyroid cartilage, and that's really easy to palpate, and you can. I wouldn't try to palpate that hyoid bone, but this thyroid cartilage you can. And it's called the thyroid cartilage because there's a gland right below it. It's not shown on this diagram, but it kind of looks like a butterfly. There's a lobe over here and a lobe over here, and that's called the thyroid gland. Right, so the thyroid cartilage is really close to the thyroid gland, tucks up right up against it here. And then down below the thyroid cartilage is the cricoid cartilage. We're going to see that the thyroid cartilage is not a complete ring around the larynx, but the cricoid cartilage is. It does completely encircle. It almost acts like a ring. And then down over here are the tracheal cartilages. Can you remember what cartilage looks like underneath the microscope, kind of like that speckle pattern? Got lacunae with, what kind of cells make up cartilage? Who remembers that? What kind of cell is that in those lacunae? Chondrocyte, that's right, because osteocyte's in bone, chondrocyte is in cartilage. Nice. All right, so, and then here I see a little bit of that epiglottis peeking up over the top, and that shows us pretty much all these cartilages. Here's a nice lateral view. I guess you have something like this for your quiz. Maybe?
Yeah.
This week? Yeah. Okay, so here's that thyroid cartilage. right? And here's that prominence. Here's the cricoid cartilage going all the way around, and you can see how big it is, especially in the posterior. Here is the epiglottis that flops over that hole in the larynx that we call the glottis. And then there's a couple other little cartilages, for instance, like the arytenoid cartilage. Okay, here's the arytenoid cartilage. Why don't I see a name going to it? Arytenoid cartilage. Ah, here, arytenoid cartilage. And there are some muscles that attach to it, and that's what can put some tension on the vocal cords or reduce tension, and that changes the pitch of your voice. Okay, so this is pretty easy to demonstrate. In lab, you might also want to find this muscle. All right, so the tracheal cartilages aren't a complete ring either. They're more like the thyroid cartilage. They're shaped like a C, and they're open in the back. But there is a ligament that attaches the two ends and a muscle, and the reason why they're open in the back, I'll find this. So let me go back to this slide here. The reason why it's open in the back, all right, so here's the back. If it was a complete hard ring all the way around, when you were to swallow something, your food would have to do what? It would go bump, 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 past all of those cartilages. And maybe some of those cartilages are so big that food won't even pass by one of those little bumps, right? So there is a more of a free space or movable space on the posterior edge of all of these parts of the tracheal cartilages so that when you swallow a bolus of food, the esophagus can expand and that food can move down into the stomach. Right? So those are C-shaped cartilages. Yeah, C, like the letter C. All right, so there shows some vocal fold. Oh, this is the slide I wanted to look. So, here is the esophagus. I don't see any cartilage. It has a couple layers of smooth muscle. Here is the trachea, and I can see a nice cartilage right here. Can you see all those chondrocytes in there? Nice, nice, nice. And what's the shape of this cartilage in the trachea? It's shaped like the letter C, right? And then here is that muscle, the trachealis muscle, that brings the two ends of the tracheal cartilages together. And then you got a nice epithelium. This was a really fancy epithelium. You had a lot of fun looking at this through the microscope in lab. Anybody remember what kind of epithelium that was right here? Okay. You can't really see what it is. You only have a little bit of a clue right here because I'm not seeing any cells. I see some cilia. Right, so this is what we call a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. And what's the job of a cilia? What is it supposed to do? What does a cilium do? Yeah, motility, for sweeping, right? Okay, because whenever we breathe in a lot of dust particles, we breathe in bacteria, viruses, all kinds of other junk, right? And if it gets down into the lungs, that's just a dead-end sac and gets trapped there, then the lungs eventually are going to fill up with junk. So as we breathe in, there are some cells, goblet cells, that secrete mucus on this inner lining of the trachea. And so dust particles and bacteria get trapped in that mucus. And they're also, it's a ciliated epithelium, so then the cilia then will sweep all that mucus-laden material, okay, in your body. Now, which way do you think these cilia are beating? Are they beating down or are they beating up? Which way would they make sense? It should be up, right? Because if it's beating down, then it would just be moving all that mucus and debris into your lungs, plugging them up even more, right? So it moves it up into your throat or your pharynx, and then when it's in your pharynx, what do you do then? You have all that stuff in your throat. What do you do with that stuff then? Yeah, you can cough. Then it's in your mouth. Then what do you do when it's in your mouth? Well, just swallow it down. Okay? Unless you're a baseball player, then yeah, you can spit. Who said spit? Who said spit? Are you a baseball player? Okay. Yeah, baseball players can spit all the time, but not us normal people, right? We should just swallow all of that debris down. That's supposed to be a joke. I'm not serious. Okay. All right, so don't forget about that special epithelium that lines the trachea. Okay, what else do we have right here? All right, what's the function of these cartilaginous rings? Once again, can you remember? We talked about it, or I talked about it. It keeps the trachea from collapsing. That's right, when we are exhaling, right? It keeps the trachea open. Because if this tube right here collapsed, then we could not exhale, which means then, of course, we couldn't inhale after that. Okay, well, bronchi has cartilage,
Right? You got right and left main bronchus. We looked at that. That extends the airway past the trachea into the lungs. Right? And okay. Then we get into another part. We get right into the lungs. All right, so we said the right lung has three lobes, the left has two. And the bronchioles in a lung no longer have cartilage on them. All right, they just have smooth muscle. Oh, you know what? Oh, look at this. All right, here's that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. Right, and then what does this look like here? Beautiful hyaline cartilage, right, a tracheal ring. All right, so you can look at that. And then here we can see the nice cilia. Okay. Yeah, it kind of looks like a sea anemone, but they're sweeping all the time, getting rid of all that junk. All right, so here we can see nice trachea, the main bronchi, right, a secondary bronchus, tertiary bronchus, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Finally, when you get into the bronchioles, right, which are microscopic, you can't see bronchioles with your naked eye, then you just have smooth muscle. And no longer a bronchus. So this is what we call the conducting zone, right? These things that are held open. This is a conducting zone, so air just passes through, but nothing special is taking place. I don't see any networks of capillaries around these bronchi, right? Even a tertiary bronchus, right? It's just cartilage holding those airways open. All right, so we want to get into the place of the lung where exchange really does take place. All right, and so we're looking in this region right here, but of course we'd have to use a microscope in order to see these things. So here we see a bronchiole and then a terminal bronchiole. It's a branch off of a bronchiole. I know that's a bronchiole because I don't see any cartilage. All right, and this terminal bronchiole will bifurcate into what we call a respiratory bronchiole. And what makes the difference here is that you see these little spherical sacs, little spheres right here. This is, okay, a little pocket of air. It's a special structure that air flows into, right? Air is going to flow through all these tubes into this pocket. And a little pocket in anatomy we call an alveolus, or anything that's shaped like that, like you might have remembered some alveolar-shaped glands, which were spherical-shaped glands. Well, here's an alveolus. Air flows into this thing, and they expand very nicely. So even this bronchiole has some alveoli, right? But if you proceed even further, then you get to a whole group of alveoli. But anywhere where you see an alveolus, exchange can take place, even if there's only one or two. If there's one or two on a bronchus, then that's what we call a respiratory bronchiole. So this looks like what? Just like a bunch of grapes. That's one way to think of this alveolar sac. And surrounding the alveolar sac is going to be a capillary network for exchange. And there's going to be another network. It's going to be a protein network, and it's going to be elastic protein. So what's the neat thing about elastic? When you stretch it and then let go, it goes back. Right, to its original length. Okay, so let's take a look at a little bit more detail. So we're looking at an alveolar sac right here. You can look at the micrograph, but maybe let's just look at the illustration. All right, so here is something coming from a respiratory bronchiole into this respiratory sac. We call that an alveolar duct. And then we have all of these passageway, all of these alveolar pores between these alveoli. And all these alveoli pretty much are spherical. And you see this network of something around this alveolus. So when we inhale, air comes in and stretches all these alveoli out. And then when we exhale, we just relax, and these elastic fibers then push down on the alveolus, clamp it down, and that forces air out of our lungs. All right, so I'm going to go over that again in just a little bit. So you got all these alveolar pores, and we have like water inside all of these alveoli right here, because that's what makes up most of our body. And so this is what you should think about next. That water that's in the lungs, when you think of water, do you think of it as being slippery or sticky? Is water slippery or sticky? You might think of it as slippery, but it really is. But I want to convince you guys that it really is sticky. Okay. As a matter of fact, have you ever been out, maybe even on the pond over here, right? If you look at the pond, the surface of water, have you ever seen an animal like walk right on the surface of water? Like a water spider, for instance? Because those water molecules are stuck together by a certain kind of bond that you're going to learn about in physiology. And that water spider is not heavy enough to break those bonds. So water molecules do get stuck together. It's called a hydrogen bond, right? Well, if there's water over here and water over here and the two walls of this alveolus touch each other, guess what's going to happen? They stick together, right? And then you won't be able to inhale. Now, is that a strong force? That's actually a pretty strong force. And I think I want to demonstrate that force to you right now. So let's pretend I got a couple walls of an alveolus right here, these two plastic transparencies, like so. And right now they're dry, right? They're dry. So if I put them together, right, just like so, nicely put together, nice and flat like that, and I pull it up, and then I put a little bit of offset so I can grab one without the other. What's going to happen to the one that I don't grab? It's going to fall down. I hope it's going to fall. Yeah, it fell down, right? As soon as I let go, it didn't get stuck together. All right, so I just said, well, we could glue these together. Do we need glue? No, we just need water. All right, so is this true? Oh, look at this. I have some water right here. Okay, remember, don't get water on your instructor. Okay, so I got some water on there right now, and I'm going to put these two transparencies together, like so. Just plop them down like that. All right, and now I'm holding both of them, so that one, I'm holding both, so one won't fall down. And then I'm just going to hold the top one. And what about the bottom one? Will it fall down?
No.
It's glued together. Okay. And as a matter of fact, if I hold the top one and you pull on the bottom one, okay, just pull it kind of gently. It's really stuck together. Like I'm lifting your arm. Oh, I pull it right out of your hands. Look, I could almost lift you right up out of your chair. That's how sticky water is. Okay, so water really is sticky. All right, so these alveoli would have no chance of expanding, right, because of that property of water we call surface tension. So how is it that we get these things to expand in our lungs normally? Because there's a cell in this alveolus that secretes something that acts like a detergent. Now, what can you tell me about water with soap in it? Is that slippery or sticky? Now, that's for sure slippery, right? And so there is something called surfactant that breaks these hydrogen bonds within this alveolus so that, okay, these alveoli can expand. But if somebody isn't producing that surfactant, then they have severely impaired pulmonary function because the alveoli aren't expanding. And typically this happens with a premature baby, right? So if somebody's born maybe very early on with cesarean section, that surfactant is being produced and they can hardly breathe as a result of that because all these alveoli are stuck together. And you probably know, what do we do with a newborn baby that's having trouble breathing because they're not producing surfactant yet? Yeah, we put them in an incubator, right? In a container that is high in oxygen and that helps their respiratory function to a large degree until these cells start to produce surfactant and their alveoli can then expand normally. All right, so that's important to understand something about that surfactant chemical. Here's a really nice illustration of an alveolar sac and some alveoli. Because not only do I see these elastic fibers around an alveolus, I also see that capillary network. It surrounds every little alveolus right here. Okay, so what's so strange about breathing in? Well, you know you need a muscle to inhale. What's the most important muscle for inhalation? Diaphragm. Yeah, so the diaphragm is dome-shaped, and when it contracts, it flattens out like so, and then when it relaxes, it goes back up like that. So you inhale when the diaphragm contracts, right, it goes down. That enlarges the thoracic cavity, and when your thoracic cavity is enlarged, that decreases the pressure inside your lungs. Atmospheric pressure stays the same, and air will move from high pressure to low pressure. If it's low pressure in your lungs, air will flow from the air into your lungs, right? As a result of that diaphragm contracting. And you need ATP to contract the diaphragm. That's an active mechanism, right? But when you're breathing quietly like we are right now, all we have to do is relax the diaphragm. There's elastic properties of the diaphragm. It will go back up. But don't forget about all these elastic fibers around each alveolus, right? As soon as you're ready to exhale, all you have to do is relax muscles, and these things will push down on the alveolus and air will move out of your lungs as a result. So exhalation is what we call passive. No ATP is necessary as long as what? As long as these elastic fibers are nice and healthy. Okay, and in some people, they're no longer healthy. They no longer work. Then you have to help recruit some other muscles to help you with exhalation. But normally, passive expiration is just passive. Doesn't require any muscles to exhale.
So we still need ATP to inspiration, right?
You need ATP for inspiration because of the diaphragm. You do not need ATP for expiration when you're breathing quietly like you are right now. That's passive. That's just relaxing. When you relax, air moves out of your lungs. Okay? Okay. So we said that there are volume changes in the lungs due to the diaphragm and maybe muscles that elevate your rib cage, that increases the area or the volume of your lungs. Have you ever have been by a fireplace and there was a little tool that was used to blow air onto the fire to get it going? Kind of looked like an accordion. Had two sides, right, two flaps on it. You could move it up and down like that, and it would, because if you were to blow on it really hard, you might pass out. So this thing is really easy to operate. All right, so that's called a bellows. So when you make the bellows with a large volume like this, is air going in or going out? It's going in. And when you make the volume small, air goes out, right, because there's an increase in pressure. So that bellows idea is really nice and easy to think about. And your lung works the same way. So guess what I have right here? I have something that is going to model your lungs, your thoracic cavity, and your diaphragm, and your trachea. So here's a hole. Okay, that's your trachea. That will allow air to enter the thoracic cavity, but in particular, we want it to go into the lungs. The balloons are the lungs, right? And this nice plastic bell right here can't change size whatsoever. So let's just say that that's the wall of the thorax. And then this black thing right here represents the diaphragm. And it's going to function just like the diaphragm, right? All right, so I'm not going to blow on this at all. So if you look at this now with the diaphragm relaxed, the diaphragm when it's relaxed is going to be dome-shaped. So I'm going to make it dome-shaped. What can you tell me about the lungs? Are they inflated or deflated?
Deflated.
Yeah, they're deflated. Can you see they're deflated? How far back can you see deflated? Can you see deflated? Yeah, can you see? Who can see deflated? That row, can you see deflated, maybe? I'm not so sure. All right, well, let's inflate these lungs, and then you might be able to tell a difference. How do I inflate these lungs right here, making the volume bigger? I can't change the shape of this glass thing, but I can change the volume by pulling on the diaphragm, pulling it down, so instead of being like this, it's going to be like that, and the volume is going to be bigger. That decreases the pressure inside here, so air is going to flow into this artificial trachea into the lungs because I have the balloons connected there. All right, so I'll hold on to there, and we breathe. What happened? Yeah, they inflated. And relax, diaphragm goes like that. What happens to the balloons? They deflate, and then they inflate when the diaphragm contracts, right, on and on and on. So this is a really nice example of just looking at, right, changes in volume of the thorax produces pressure changes that can inflate and deflate a lung. Right. And remember, inflation is due to muscle contraction. And expiration, when you're quiet breathing, how would you explain expiration, the mechanics of expiration during quiet breathing? In one word. Yeah, it's passive. And it's due to what kind of protein? I see it right here. What are these little proteins?
Elastic.
Yeah, those elastic fibers, right? Those elastic fibers then constrict an alveolus and the air flows out. So guess what? So an alveolus is just a sac, right? So here I have two sacs. Here's a paper bag. I'm going to use this one later on the way home. And then here I have a balloon, right? A nice stretchy balloon. And let's blow air into both of these, and then you have to tell me which one is a better model of a real live alveolus. Okay, so we got two. Maybe you can see what's going to happen already. So here is that paper bag. Like I said, I'm going to need this later. I kind of open it up just a little bit, then put an alveolar duct in it right here so that I can blow some air, right, like that. So I blow air in here, what's going to happen? It's going to expand, right? Nice. Okay. Then I grab that alveolar duct so air can't escape. I'll keep it there for a minute, right, while I work with the balloon. So I want, again, I want you to tell me, what's a better idea of an alveolus, this thing here or the balloon? All right, so now I'll go to this other model of an alveolus. I hope it works because they were. I blew up about five of them and they just burst in lab, but I'll try this one. Hopefully it won't burst. That's all I'm going to do. I'm going to try. I could blow it up more, but I don't want it. Oops, sorry. I don't want it to burst. Okay. So here we have a balloon. All right. That's filled with air. Here we have an alveolus filled with air. Here we have an alveolus filled with air. All right. And if I open up this alveolar duct and let go with a paper bag, what's going to happen to the paper bag? I open it up. Air can go in and out. And did you see any change in the size? No. It's just going to stay the same size because the paper bag doesn't have what? Elastic fibers. Now, what about this balloon over here? It has elastic fibers. So if I let go, what's going to happen to all the air inside the balloon? It's going to fly out, right? So I'll just do that. Oh, good. I didn't smack anybody in the face. So which one is a much better model of an alveolus, a balloon or paper bag?
Balloon,
much better. Okay. And that's for passive breathing. So don't forget about all these elastic fibers right there. Pretty important. Okay, so let me put this away. Okay. I got to go a couple more slides. Maybe one more slide, two slides. So here we've looked. Now we've cut open the lung, opened up, got our microscopes out, because I know we have some microscopes because what do we see? I see some cells, right, with a nucleus right here. And so this has a capillary, and it also has the wall of the alveolus. And you can see how thin these things are. Here's a capillary. Well, what do you got in a capillary right here? I see some red blood cells, right? I see some red blood cells. All right, and then the alveolus, we have air. And I see a couple different kinds of cells. I see a type 1 cell that makes the wall of the alveolus. And so that's an epithelium. What kind of epithelium does it look like to you? Let's look at it right on edge, right here. Yeah, it's a simple squamous epithelium, right? So that kind of epithelium is specialized for exchange. So things can move across it one way or the other. All right? And then here is that capillary. Here's one cell that makes up the endothelium. So again, it's just one cell layer thick, but these are really thin cells. So for oxygen to diffuse into the blood, it only has to go through this really thin layer of the wall of the alveolus, really thin layer wall of the capillary, right? And then there's a little tiny interstitial space filled with some fluid that's hardly not there. And then don't forget, what's coating the inside of this alveolus? What's the chemical that's in the water? So there's a layer of water with a chemical. Yeah, surfactant, right? So if we zoom into this area, okay, I can see the wall of the alveolus, right? And the wall's made up of a type 1 cell. Here is the endothelial cell of the capillary. See some nice plasma and red blood cells. And this is sometimes what we call the respiratory membrane. This is the membrane that oxygen can actually diffuse back and forth through because it is what? Is it thick or is it thin? It's super thin, right? It's super thin and delicate. So you guys should really take really good care of your lungs because it is so delicate. It's very delicate tissue. It can be damaged pretty easily. And don't forget about all those elastic fibers, too, that can be damaged. All right, so that is what we call the respiratory membrane. The only thing that I want to point out to you is don't forget about that layer of surfactant. Now, your book does not include surfactant as part of the respiratory membrane, but in your pre-lecture reading assignment, I do. Right, because I don't want you to forget about that surfactant. So what's this respiratory membrane? Well, you got a layer of surfactant. You've got the wall of the alveolus. You've got this little interstitial space, and then you have the wall of the capillary. And that's how nutrients and gases diffuse from one place to the other. And how do they diffuse? How would you think of diffusion? Why does a molecule like oxygen diffuse? Why does it move from one place to another? You could think that there's a little genie in here, grab this molecule, throws it into the capillary, but that doesn't happen. Okay. Diffusion means that things will move just by a concentration gradient, right? So if I open a perfume bottle here, perfume is really a high concentration in my hand, and it's low concentration in the back of the room, and guess what's going to happen to that perfume? It's just going to move to the back of the room by diffusion. So things move from high concentration to low. So we see oxygen going in because oxygen is high in the air and low in your body. So oxygen diffuses in. CO2, on the other hand, we see is diffusing out because CO2 is high in your body, and what is it in the air? It's very, very low. It's almost zero. Right, so there's a big concentration gradient, so CO2 leaves our body very easily. All right, so the type 1 cell makes the wall of the alveolus, and the type 2 cell that I see here, okay, type 2 cell, here it is right here, type 2 cell. These are the cells, of course they make up the wall of the alveolus, but these are actually the cells that make surfactant and secrete it so that these alveoli don't get stuck together. Yeah, so here's a type 2 surfactant secreting cell. Here's just a wall type 1 cell. And then I see some other cells, highly variable. These are macrophages, right? These were a white blood cell at one time that crawled out of the capillary into the wall of this alveolus. And they're shapeshifters, so they can move by diapedesis. They just squish part of their body in one direction, and they move around looking for things that don't belong in an alveolus. Maybe it's a tumor, maybe it's a bacteria, maybe a virus, fungi, dust particles, things like that. So these things will keep your lungs clean, right? The macrophages. Yeah, macrophage. Okay. What else do I want to talk about? Mechanics of breathing, talked about that just a little bit. Oh, good. Okay. Let's talk about the serous membrane around the lungs. So what is a serous membrane, once again? What's a serous membrane as opposed to a mucous membrane? Let's start with mucous membrane. What's a mucous membrane? Yeah, lines a cavity, not open to the outside world, right? So a serous membrane lines a cavity that's closed, right? So mucous membrane, I was looking for a picture, maybe I misspoke. Mucous membrane lines a cavity that's open to the outside world, like oral cavity, nasal cavity, reproductive tract, right? Urinary tract, digestive tract. Those are all cavities that are open to the outside world, so that's a mucous membrane. But the inside of your lungs, okay, the inside of your lungs are open to the outside world, but the outside of your lungs are not open to the outside world. And that is means then that there is a serous membrane around them. Rats, I don't see. Oh yeah, this is a pretty good example. All right, so there's a serous membrane. And a mucous membrane just has one part. But what about a serous membrane? How many different divisions are there? How many parts? Yeah, there's three parts to it. Right, there is a part that's right on the organ inside your body, and that's a visceral organ because it's inside a cavity, not open to the outside world. So we call that the visceral part of that serous membrane. And here we have a lung. Here's the thoracic wall. Let's zoom into this area. So here is the lung, and the membrane right on the surface of the lung, this visceral organ, is called the visceral pleura. So the pleural membrane is specifically around what organ in your body? Lung, yeah. Right, so you have many serous membranes, but the only one around your lungs is the pleural serous membrane. Right, so here is the visceral right on the surface of the lung. Then, a little bit more superficial, we have a space, right, and we call that the serous cavity, but since it's around the lungs, we're going to call that the pleural cavity, and that should be a really small space, probably shouldn't have any air in it whatsoever, very little fluid. And then, the membrane that's right on the surface of the chest wall is what we call the parietal division of that serous membrane, or the parietal pleural. So going from superficial to deep, we've got the parietal division, the cavity, and then the visceral division of the pleura. And now in this layer, right, the pleural cavity, do you think we should have surfactant in here, or should we have water? Would it be good to stick, glue the surface of the lung to the thoracic wall, or would it be good so that this space could expand and contract when we're breathing? Okay. All right. I want to convince you otherwise. Well, in order to inhale, right, we expand the thoracic cavity, and since the lung is attached to, right, the visceral pleura is attached via surface tension to the parietal pleura, when we expand the lungs, or the rib cage, guess what? That pulls on the lungs as well. And that increases the volume of the lungs. And then air flows in. So in this particular case, we don't want surfactant in the pleural cavity like we want surfactant inside the alveolus, because we want the alveolus to expand. But in this case, we want water so that the lung really does attach itself to the thoracic wall. You sort of see what I'm talking about there? So we do want the lung to be glued to the thoracic wall. Because, why? Let me see if I can find another figure right here. Bless you. Ah, here. Okay. So here we have three circumstances. What are these three circumstances? Okay. So at rest, this dotted line represents the volume of a lung, right? When you're just at rest, and then you start to inhale, guess what the lung has to do? It has to expand, right? So if the wall of the lung, right, the exterior wall of the lung is attached to the wall of the thorax, then when we enlarge the thorax by using these muscles on the thoracic wall, it actually pulls on the surface of the lung and helps expand the lung. All right, so the lung can go from the dotted line to this solid colored line, and if there's no surfactant in this pleural space, which there isn't, right, it acts like glue, so when we expand our thoracic cavity, the lung gets pulled along with it, increasing the volume, decreasing the pressure inside the lung so air goes in. All right, so that is, so there should always be a little bit of negative pressure in this pleural space, and it should be just a nice watery environment that attaches the lungs to the thoracic wall. Okay, so no surfactant in this space. Like in the alveolus, we definitely want surfactant. Oh, it looks like it's 12:04, so we got about 30 seconds. So you know what? We're going to come back and finish up respiratory system next time. Sign-in sheet is going around.
Yeah, I know.